Just two things of which you must beware. Don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, they got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. See, the halibuts and the sturgeons are being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste. Just go out for a breath of air and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill. If the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. Then you can breathe long as you don't inhale. Lots of things there that you can drink, but stay away from the kitchen sink, the breakfast garbage that you throw into the bay. They drink at lunch in San Jose. So go to the city, see the crazy people there, like lambs to the slaughter. They're drinking the water and breathing the air.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. We want to remind you that the opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, volunteers, underwriters, or programmers. We're really pleased to have in the studio today Patrick Newman. He's well known in our community for his work on behalf of the homeless. He's an outspoken critic of, well, lots of things. And we've always enjoyed talking with Patrick. He's especially good at pointing out some of the hypocrisies of liberals, and his letters to the editor often make us squirm. We anticipate that that may happen to us in the next hour. Welcome, Patrick Newman.
Good to be here. Thanks so much for having me on. It's good to be here with you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we want to remind you that the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or volunteers.
Well, we're going to do this interview as more of a discussion than a typical interview. So we're sitting around three microphones today, and we're just going to chat. We thought we'd open up. Patrick and I bumped into each other at Grocery Outlet the other day. I had a cart full of alcoholic beverages. He had a smaller cart. I can't recall. But we talked about, and among other things, the topic that came up was the 50s and the 60s and some of the kind of early warning signs that the planet was deeply in trouble. That's why that opening tune was Tom Lehrer, 1959. It takes me back to my senior year in high school when I discovered Tom Lehrer, loved him. And I think it had a lot to do with the development of my values. He recognized pollution was an issue, and we'll probably play a couple other Tom Lehrer songs before the hour is out. But I'll stop talking in just a moment. Let Patrick talk. He mentioned E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful, 1957. I thought of, again, in 1959, I heard a lecture by a guy who was working with Vance Packard, who wrote a book called The Hidden Persuaders. And there was research that showed that if they did brief flashes of a sign in a movie theater saying, eat popcorn, the popcorn sales went up. A little bit later, J.G. Ballard wrote a short story called The Subliminal Man, where a guy's driving along the expressway and he just has this powerful urge to buy a pack of cigarettes. He pulls off, buys smokes, and they discover that subliminal persuasion is being used. But Packard then went on to talk about the waste makers, conspicuous consumption. And there were a number of other folks in that era that we can talk about.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, and Paul Ehrlich, whom we've interviewed on this show a few times, wrote The Population Bomb, and that was in 1968. And in fact, it, although his dire reports of what would happen with the population bomb have not shown themselves to be true, we do have a population bomb. We have a world that has more people than we can support in a sustainable way.
Yeah. You had Paul Ehrlich on the air here?
Yes, a couple times. Yeah, he's at Berkeley. He runs a group called The Mob. Mm-hmm. And
M-A-H-B.
M-A-H-B,
it's
right.
The Millennium Alliance of Humanities and the Biosphere, or something like that.
He pops up once in a while, and I have a chance to read some of his latest thinking off and on. We could start with Paul Ehrlich and work backwards. The thing that sticks out for me with Paul Ehrlich is what I see, probably an oversimplified version of it, but his recognition through time that population was sort of one side of the coin and the other side was consumption, and that he has talked about underemphasizing consumption as the other element. So there's kind of been, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, he didn't say this, but I look at it as sort of a population bomb and a consumption bomb that went off at the same time. And both of those bombs went off really at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and especially with the use of massive amounts of fossil fuels that could support more and more complex economies with larger, well, just gross calorie production with the synthesis of, you know, the first nitrogen, you know, fertilizers. So you had a population explosion at the same time, a consumption explosion. And it all goes together with an amazing vehicle for especially the consumption end, which is, you know, capitalism, or what people call late capitalism, which there's no better tool ever developed for, as you were saying, referencing back to Vance Packard, massive consumption and motivating people to consume on the level that we consume today and see as normal, which has never been normal in history.
And you know, I've thought about this when, especially when I spent some time in Romania, and Romania was just a few years out of communism with the fall of Ceausescu, and one of my friends in Romania said, with Ceausescu, we had lots of things on the nothing on the grocery shelves, money to buy it, but nothing there. Now we have lots of things on the grocery shelves, but we can't afford it. Mm. And they were wanting to have what Americans had. You know, we want all the cool stuff that you have. And so here, already overly consuming and eating up more of the world's resources than are ours, we have other countries wanting to do the same thing. So we're, you know, we've taught capitalism as the way to go. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to happen, but it's happening enough to put a lot of pressure on the planet.
Yeah. So going all the way back to the, you know, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the Agricultural Revolution, and when we became settled societies, you have this question of surpluses and how they're going to be distributed. So those questions of justice arose there, and then that battle has been going on now for 10,000 years. Capitalism is the latest version of how we produce and distribute, and it's fraught with issues, but it's just the latest version of the same struggle of what you do. Mm-hmm. There's one Sitting Bull quote that I always come back to, and he was. You know, obviously Plains Indian, and ended up at one point with the Wild West show later in his life. So he visited big cities like Chicago, and he looked around and he saw, you know, what we produced in our world and versus, you know, the life of, you know, forager, hunter, Plains Indian life. And he ended up getting paid pretty well in the Wild West show, and he gave a lot of his money away to homeless people on the streets. It's pretty ironic. But he had this thing where he said, the white man knows how to make everything, but he doesn't know how to distribute it. And that was his, like, one sentence synopsis of what he saw. And it's powerful, because it's true. We're really powerful, incredibly powerful in creating, you know, massive amounts of stuff we're not so good at distributing it, and we're not so good at looking at the consequences of what that, in terms of what that means for the world on all kinds of levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking, too, this morning that the end of World War II catalyzed a lot of it. Brokaw called the World War II vets the greatest generation, and we were talking beforehand about maybe our generation, those of us who are now in our 60s, 70s, and 80s may not have done so great. Mm-hmm. But the greatest generation then felt entitled to have a lot of babies, mm-hmm. to build the suburbs, to have the stuff they had earned by defeating the menace of Hitler.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the conspicuous consumption stuff came about in that era.
Right. So there's this confluence of, world domination, domination of markets, access to resources and materials, access to markets, and then the science of how to market things to people, which exploded in the 1950s, and that's what Vance Packard took a hard look at. They were all, like we were talking about the other day, they were all kind of like red flags, and the criticism that was happening in the 50s and 60s and 70s, which is sort of the little retrospective that we were doing that day. There's red lights on the dashboard if we want to read those books and mm-hmm. take them seriously mm-hmm. and look at what social commentaries. And there was a lot of really quite popular analysis of these things at that level at that time, because mm-hmm. you and I are old enough to remember that. I think Small is Beautiful came out in 67. That was a best-selling book. A very radical book, but a lot of people read it. I mean, when I say a lot, I'm probably talking about 1% of society, but that's a lot more than nothing. And oftentimes, those kind of things just remain completely obscure. So there was a conversation happening. I mean, I saw Schumacher speak at the Cal Palace when I was a kid. I was like 15, 16 years old. It was a large venue with a lot of people there, So these radical voices that were really saying, we need to find a different way of life because this one is not, in the today's terms, sustainable. They were there. The voices mm-hmm. were there. We heard those voices, yeah.
And, of course, it was a big social revolution time. That was my era. My mm-hmm. era was the era of protest songs and We Shall Overcome and Christianity being called out as something that should actually be lived, and that Christians, Martin Luther King's Christianity challenged the Christianity, I think, of a lot of people who were resisting social mm-hmm. change in that way. But at least Christianity had a part in the conversation that was toward progress and change and love and kindness and acceptance and tolerance. And where did that go? I mean, mm-hmm. the Christianity and even a lot of my civil rights involvement was through the church. And that just went away. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Christians changed their direction.
Yeah. So when
I can't recognize Christians today. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many of this the.
We just have to qualify. Not all Christians.
I'm in the middle of a sentence here.
Yes,
well, the disclaimer was read at the beginning, right? Not all views. Or,
yeah. No, my best friend is a Methodist minister. One of my best friends. So
yeah, yeah.
I know that not all Christians are right wing. But what we see in Christianity and the churches in our community, there are some very socially conscious, helpful Christians in our community that are helping in leadership positions. But
I think we can unpack that a little bit without offending everybody. I think the way to unpack it is to think about justice Christianity versus what I would call charity Christianity. So what I think Martin Luther King was talking about was justice Christianity. And so just recently I got onto the Amos chapter 5 from the Old Testament, and it's that, justice running down like water, that whole, it's a beautiful, beautiful chapter. And William Barber, who's a pretty well-known kind of black radical preacher, uses that to preach on. So it's something I just came on to, and I like it. But the thing is, there's sections in that are quite challenging in terms of the people and what this prophet is saying. He's basically saying, look, God wants justice. God wants something more than what he's seeing here. And it doesn't, it's challenging and it's condemning and it's demanding when you read this text,
mm-hmm.
In that true, like, prophetic voice. Because God doesn't want us just to be nice. God wants justice in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That voice in Christianity, I think it's fair to say that it's always been kind of the, I don't want to use the word marginalized, but it's not a voice that's very comfortable. Because when we start talking about justice, I mean, charity's kind of fuzzy. It's like, I can be loving and charitable. But when we start talking about justice, now we're talking about some painful subjects. When we look around at the world and we say, well, is there really justice there? And this gets into this whole question of looking at the suffering of the world. Is that suffering really suffering that can't be avoided? Or is that suffering that comes out of our way of life and the fact that we're not living just lives? So that's a kind of radical, and I think that radical voice is there in Jesus too, because mm-hmm. he talks about the
yes.
poor, and he talks about, he stands with the poor, and he demands things for the poor. It's all there in Matthew 25. It's the same voice that's in Amos. So what, you know, we can say, just as with our own lives, I mean, my own life, is there's a huge gap between who I think I should be and what I am. And there's a huge gap between what Christianity should be and what it is. That's to not think that is to not be, I think, to not have perspective. Because there's ideals in Christianity that are impossible to achieve. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to achieve them or that Christians shouldn't try to achieve them, but you have to recognize that between who I am and that ideal, there's a lot of ground, and there's something that I can learn from looking at that gap. If I stop seeing that gap there, then there's a big, huge thing that's useful and powerful about ideals that I'm missing, because ideals are sort of, I think, meant to make us aware of some painful realities about who we are. So that should be there in Christianity, that voice.
I also think that charity Christianity is a lot more powerful than we see it being. Just, you know, in my understanding of Christianity, I am no longer a Christian, so I'll just talk about from the past, that Christianity involves self-sacrifice. It's not, and it involves charity being self-sacrifice as well, that you give away, if you find someone, if you see someone in need, you give away something that you have that might not be easy to give away, that you might want to keep. And so I think charity in the Christian sense is a lot harder than just, sending secondhand T-shirts to Africa,
mm-hmm.
which there's a lot of, I think.
Mm-hmm. Were you wanting to get in there?
Go ahead.
Okay. It's this question of what is justice? What does that mean? Like, how do you, when we look at the world, right? So, somebody I always talk about. I really like Tolstoy's later work, the last 20 years of his life. He had these, you know, we might have talked about this on the other radio show when we got together, I can't remember. But he had a sort of a radical transformation in the last 20 years of his life, where he left his old life behind and he became a radical Christian. His version of radical Christianity is, he's essentially challenging the entire status quo of his society. He's challenging his echelon,
mm-hmm.
the aristocrats of Russia. He's calling out the entire way of life. He's calling out war. He's calling out capital punishment. He's calling out consumption. And he's saying to his own peers, look, it takes 100 peasants working themselves dawn to dusk to make my kind of life possible, and the kind of life where, you know, I have a coach and I go to the ballet and I toss my coins out the window to the beggars. I mean, he talks about all this, mm-hmm. and he writes many essays about this. That made him a bit of a pariah, because this is not a voice that people wanted to hear. He was challenging the entire, you know, structure. So there's a voice of radical justice Christianity in Tolstoy at that point that I really like. And one of the things he talks about is essentially that charity can be used to cover injustice very effectively.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, and he talks about, I remember which pope it was at the time, but he he reads one of the encyclicals that comes from the Vatican, and in that, this Pope says, you can't expect anyone to cut into their kind of like their nest egg. But what's left from that, where you can justify—I forget the word—but it's like the excess. That is, you are morally required to share with your neighbor. So Tolstoy looks
big
at that
moral reach,
right? So Tolstoy looks at that, and he said, and he eviscerates that idea, and he says, that's really not at the core of what Jesus was saying. And in fact, if you look at radical Christianity in the sense to take Jesus at his word, he says, give everything you have to the poor and follow me. And he also says, and your use of violence to protect anything or anyone, these are not things that any Christian does. I mean, just being part of a state and having possessions. So, okay, there's the big gap, yawning gap between, what's at the core of, a radical Christian walking the walk and what we do. Okay, so now it's, well, what do you do with that? And so to your question, like, how far, where's the line drawn between being a good person and a charitable person and going beyond that line to where we start to ask questions about, well, what kind of fundamental injustice is happening, to the people of the world, to the animals of the world, to the environment of the world that I am culpable for, even, well beyond what I could possibly cover with any charitable act. And I know that that's true because I can't do enough charity to cover justice. Anyway, that's kind of rambling, but it's an interesting subject.
Who are you speaking to when you say that? Who is your audience when you say to look at that? Who can or will hear that? What you just said. Look at those things and see where the gap is between, what your ideal is and what you do.
Well, first of all, myself, like we were talking about earlier, this question of, when I get up in the morning, do I think, am I a good person that does good things and follows the rules, or am I a person that gets up in the morning and thinks, I am a culpable person because of what I've been born into and what I know in my day-to-day life is causing suffering in the world that shouldn't be caused? Is that my premise, or is the other one my premise? And so the first thing is that voice I should hear and try to repeat and hear again and hear again and hear again. And that's an ongoing process that's not going to end, and I'm not going to achieve any of that in my lifetime because I know it's impossible. But I also know that it's a direction. So in terms of a culture, the question is, how morally vital is Christianity? How morally vital is socialism? How morally vital is any belief system that I decide to adopt, any ideology? And to me, that question comes back to, it's only as morally vital as it allows me to get closer to the suffering of the world, to hear it, to act on that suffering, what that suffering is asking me to do, to object to that suffering, and to keep going back to that well. So this is, I'm trying to get to the question of who can that be delivered to? And I think the question, my answer is to myself, and then in terms of the world, I guess my bigger question would be, how morally vital is our process? Because also, as we were talking about earlier, there seems to be a lot of evidence that if we're talking about functional morality that eliminates as much as possible the unnecessary suffering of the world, and we look around at the world, and like we said earlier also, if you look at the amount of human suffering, the amount of animal suffering, the nuclear weapons we have ready to go, and the fact that we're in a period of possible total environmental collapse, we have to ask the question of how functional our morality is, because we're all doing something. We're all part of that in some way.
I'm trying to think of the best way to ask this, so I'm going to just ask it in the simplest way. Do you think most people care about morality? Do you think people long to be moral people? I think they, as I said to you before the show too, I think people want to be good and they think of themselves as good, but I don't think that good equates with morality, because morality implies a system in which you establish what your beliefs are and how you will act on those beliefs, whereas being good is pretty passive. I don't do anything to hurt anybody. And I was mentioning my brother, who was a drug dealer and a drug addict and did some bad things. And he thought he was a good guy. Mm-hmm. He just did these bad things. And, you know, he had rationalizations for doing those bad things. And he thought of himself as good and, you know, a loving family member. But I think it's a passive good, you know. And so my issue is what's happened to morality in all of human history.
Yeah.
Do people have their? I mean, of course, there have been movements where, and big movements even where people have wanted a moral center and wanted to act on that moral center. But I think that we're, you know, I'm only 78 years old. I haven't been around that long. But I always look back to the 60s as a golden age. It seemed like there was a concern. The war on poverty, we took it really seriously. The people that I was with, mm-hmm. You know, I went to work in communities, poor communities, and that went away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Steve,
I wanted to ask, how do we derive that system of morality? We interviewed a guy a couple of years ago, Michael Simon, who talks about the scientific nature of good and evil. Mm-hmm. And he says, really, good comes from a genetic predisposition to form communities, mm-hmm. and evil comes from a genetic fight or flight, sense of flight, and whichever one dominates. That was simplistic, of course, but he said basically xenophobia, fight or flight, that's where the bad stuff comes from, and mm-hmm. the desire to find community and probably live the golden rule. But the whole question comes, we're in, as the existentialist phrased it, in a universe that is amoral. Mm-hmm. That we do have to derive those for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of common agreement on what mm-hmm. is a good morality, but mm-hmm. I would like to hear, as part of this, how you think we go about establishing moral principles then that we can follow and say for sure that's the right way to do it.
Well, so then the question would be, if those ideals were held up in the 60s, and if I don't get to that, those ideals were held up in the 60s, and it was such a like a blast from the past to hear that song.
Yeah,
Tom Lehrer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I heard it probably like 50 years ago.
Yeah.
Probably the last time I heard it, and it took me kind of straight back. So all these ideals are being held up, and we've got a kind of social movement and a kind of popular sense of what our moral direction might be. So, from my perspective, like what's missing, like what. Why is the train off the track, or how? What's lost? Why didn't those roots go deeper into a deeper mm-hmm. sense of what our moral responsibility is?
Mm-hmm.
And so, from where I'm sitting now in my little dogma, it's a question of education. Like, what kind of moral education do we have from the time we're children? Okay, well, it's a kind of moral education, and so let's just say, it's a kind of dysfunctional moral education where we're taught from time we're little kids that the world is a hierarchical place. We're born into a hierarchy. As we grow up, we learn a sense of identity, which is like where we are in the hierarchy. That sense of who we are in the hierarchy is extremely important to us. We learn this at a deep, deep level, a visceral level, and it's well defended. And it has to do, from my point of view, with how we look at the suffering of the world, the information that we need, because that's the only place we can go to for morally vital information, is to look at the unnecessary suffering of the world and ask ourselves what our role in it is, where it came from, how it's part of my way of life. This hierarchical view of the world that we learn and we're totally indoctrinated into tells us that the importance of the suffering in the hierarchy is directly related to where it is in the hierarchy. So if it's suffering at the top of the hierarchy, that's really important suffering. And if the closer I am to the top of the hierarchy, the more important my suffering is. But of course, I'm always going to think it's important. But as I look at the world, the further down the hierarchy we go, the less and less and less, exponentially less loudly we hear the suffering. So that, and I would kind of reference Jesus that in this way, where he says the first shall be last and the last shall be first. There's an absolute need to turn that whole pyramid upside down and get the information out of that part of the hierarchy where we're completely tuned out. Because if you look at an environmental question, you know, which hopefully we'll get into some more of that. If you look at an environmental question and say, well, what's the problem here? Why, you know, why are we living a way of life that we know is destroying the life on the planet, that's destroying the biosphere? We know we're doing this. I'm doing it. It's part of my life. That's baked in the cake. How can that be? Well, what's the relationship between that way of life and these kinds of moral principles I'm talking about? So that if you were looking at the world and you're educated differently, if you look at the world and you're educated differently with respect to the hierarchy, you would think that the suffering at the very bottom that's least heard is the most suffering, and the suffering that we can get the most information out of in terms of our moral lives. Well, what's at the bottom? Well, I guess you could say, well, it's that coral reef in Australia that's dying right now that I'm not hearing at all, unless I turn this thing upside down. There's life forms there that I was taught from the time I was a little kid are like on the other side of a divide, like in my Catholic upbringing. You know, there's the side of the divide where, you know, there's a soul, and that's humans. And there's a kind of human exceptionalism in that says, you know, as a human, I have, you know, I can potentially have eternal life. I am made in the image and likeness of God. I was literally taught that. There's a red line between me and all other life. That's a very interesting hierarchical principle there.
The great chain of being.
Right. So that lesson, which was taken in stride, and in many ways just, you know, I have to be a Catholic to keep thinking that. Most people, whether they have a faith-based version of the world or not, have a version of the world that says, yeah, that suffering is far less important than X, Y, Z as I go down the, you know, okay. As long as that's my moral practice, then I cannot possibly have moral vitality in the world because I'm not hearing the suffering of the world that I need to hear in order to make different kinds of moral, to change my moral direction so that, you see where I'm going with all that?
Yeah, I do. And here's what I think happens. I think people live in realities that allow them to easily ignore that, to just say, that's not my world, and I'm not going to think about it. They cut themselves off. And I think that's really obvious with climate change. You know, I don't believe that, and so I don't have to do anything. And I think about this when people get illnesses. They never believed that they were mortal. They didn't think they were going to die. Of course, I know everybody dies. Everybody dies. We know that. But I didn't know I was going to die. And I think that's the way people are about climate change. Even people that believe that there's climate change and they can see the disaster, they can say, and I have granddaughters, I think that their family says, we'll be okay, for whatever reasons they use to say we'll be okay. And I think that's also true with moral issues. I don't engage in that, so therefore I'm not culpable. And you're asking for people to look at it, and people are refusing to look at it because it's painful. And it asks them to do something. It asks them to maybe give things up, to maybe be less comfortable than they are, to maybe not have every brand new toy that comes out. Because every brand new toy that comes out, it's like the, you know, for every horse and carriage guy, there are 100 peasants making that possible. And I think that people just turn away.
100 peasants and 100,000 pounds of carbon.
However
we want to, like, stack it all
right,
up.
There's
consequences,
And they're not small consequences. They're huge consequences. No. They're material consequences.
So we have dozens or hundreds of ways of baffling all this stuff so that we don't have
Absolutely.
To go there.
Absolutely.
And these things are in my consciousness, too, because this is what I was conditioned to do.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talk about this, like 99% of me is still, you know, if I'm looking at this as a different way of life, in other words, saying, well, look, the principle is I want to look at the suffering of the world, I want to learn from it, I want to see what my culpability is and what my moral objection is and practice that discipline. Okay, how much of that realistically is in the way I live. Well, it's a very small fraction, because most of me is rooted in this other reality that I learned from the time I was a kid, which is it's a hierarchical world. Here's my little place in the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. There's my identity. Really hard to break that down. And it's really painful to go into the suffering and listen to it and sit with it and actually do what it says, which is the discipline I think I should follow. Now, we talked earlier, too, about this weekly gathering that we have on the plaza. The purpose of that from my, in terms of my religion, is to do that, to go at least once a week and spend an hour or two with what I think is a really visible and obvious kind of unnecessary suffering right in my midst, and then let it work on me in an osmotic way. So there isn't a plan, there isn't a conscious thing going on. Just go, be there, know people, watch them die, watch them suffer, let it in a little bit. You know, so if I was a giant, a moral giant, I could let a lot in, but I'm not. I'm a morally very limited person. But I do know that that little exercise has had an impact on me, because I know there's things that I do that I can't not do because that voice is coming through there. Like I've pulled the curtain back and I let that voice in. I think you can do that with the environment. I think you can pull that curtain back and let that voice in more, the suffering of the environment, and then then it starts to tell you, no, that way of life is no longer morally sustainable. So that's a practice. And then I think it's true with animal suffering too, to pull back those, you know, in terms of just where animal rights people come from, to pull back the curtain on that and to let it in, get closer to it, get it, make it intimate. And then it has a voice and it speaks. And it's not like it's a literal thing where we know what it's going to say. We don't. That's part of the thing. It's like I can't know what it's going to say. If I knew that, I'd already know what was good. But I don't know what's good because I'm not listening to the suffering that I'm creating and that's around me. That's how I know what's good. But that's a whole different exercise than what I was taught to do and what most people do. Most people follow rules. And I'd go to the suffering every day and go, I'm going to listen to the suffering of the world and I'm going to let it tell me, let it inform my moral life. That's not what we've taught. That's not the practice we were taught. But there are ways to do it. Yeah, but I do it poorly. Very poorly. Yeah.
Better than 99.99% of the world.
It's a pioneering exercise in a sense. Like,
What you said about hierarchy, where you are in the hierarchy, that I think that really rings true to me. And what that means, your place in the hierarchy and what you know about that, or just implicitly know. You know, you don't know it explicitly, but that has such a huge determining effect on how you behave, what you buy,
what we see, what you know, what we let in,
and so a lot just isn't let in. Because like, what did you use? What word did you use? Baffles or blinders, or you know, you're in your
There are very many devices, and some of them are supernatural devices. We have certain supernatural belief systems that tell us that, you know, put suffering in some kind of order. You know, let's pick on Hinduism for a minute and say, well, okay, we're born into a world where there's karma and dharma, and the suffering of the world is all explained. I can look across the landscape and see someone over there dying of starvation and think, oh, well, they're dying of starvation because they were born to that experience, because they need to go through this evolutionary process. That's the suffering they need. Okay, well, that's completely at odds with the whole concept of justice. Look at something like the kind of Oprah secret talk, you know, about the magical thinking that goes with the law of attraction, which is very popular and has been popularized in the United States through, you know, people that have been on the Oprah program, right? They write books about this law of attraction. Everything's made up in your mind. You are the author, and you know, you have the agency to create your reality, or you have the power to create your reality. Okay, the world is infinite. There's infinite abundance. We just make this up. If you're suffering, it's because you don't have the right mindset.
If you don't have
abundance in your life, it's because you don't have the right mindset.
I see what you mean.
It's not that there's a finite amount of stuff and that we have to deal with these dirty, ugly questions of justice. It's that, oh, there's a magical envelope that I can step into and think everything's in its place. And not only that, but if I have the right mindset, there will be infinite abundance for me. That's not a scientific view. It's not an empirical view. It's a magical, supernatural view.
And it's
at odds with morality,
right,
fundamentally.
And it's a view that people of privilege have. It's not a view that people of privilege have, because I think, in fact, people do create their own reality, but you can't say what that reality is for anybody else. You can't say, oh, create this reality because I did it and it worked for me. Mm-hmm, you know, it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, if everything lines up and you happen to have a Maserati and you think it was because you put it up on your, whatever it's called, little wish board or whatever,
mm-hmm,
you
feel right,
like a picture, and then you have one, well, yeah. Is it because you put that on the board, or is it because there's a kind of huge and important set of circumstances that have allowed for it, that all have moral implications, if I'm looking at the world mm-hmm. as a finite mm-hmm. place mm-hmm. where there's justice and injustice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just in questions, like you said earlier, of distribution, that are really painful questions to ask, that we ought to be asking.
Mm-hmm.
But I only bring those examples up because there's a multiplicity of these devices that mm-hmm. we learn
right.
and use, because they help us to retain that position in the hierarchy and legitimize it so that we can go forward with our day and do what we do, and essentially act without a real deep sense of culpability
right.
and contrition and what deep morality would ask of us.
I'm wondering what psychologists, I just started thinking about this, what psychologists would say about that, because I'm feeling really judgy right now.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, that's... feeling guilt and judging and having other people feel your judgment is not necessarily mm-hmm. what a healthy person should or would do.
You have a way of putting your finger on things. It's pretty amazing, actually. I don't know you that well, but we had an earlier conversation, too, and it's like... Anyway, excellent question. Like, and this is something I think about a lot, and I've talked to some of my friends, and if they happen to hear this, they'll say, oh, yeah. There's a fork in the road sometimes between psychology and morality. In other words,
interesting.
If I think, well, okay, what's the best thing for me in terms of my sense of well-being at this moment, and what's the right thing, they may not be the same thing. So maybe I lower my stress level by buying a plane ticket to France and spending a few weeks in Provence or whatever, because that's good for me psychologically. I feel good when I'm there. It relieves my stress. I feel fantastic, and I need to take care of myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, there's a lot of questions about which path we're on and whether or not they're converging or diverging or whatever, but I think at some moments, this is a really tough nut to crack, because I think at some moments... we are, if we're looking at things strictly morally, I think we're being asked to make sacrifices mm-hmm. that may not necessarily be in accord with what, you know, psychological wellness necessarily will require.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really tough question.
It's a really tough question for me.
Yeah. I tend, you know, maybe it's my Catholic background or something, but I mean, we were talking about religion earlier. I'm not a believer at this point in that sense, but I do resonate with a lot of the symbolism and the beauty of some of that,
of
those belief systems. So what's going on with the whole thing with the crucifixion, the whole story there, and Socrates drinking the hemlock, and mm-hmm. you go through history, Martin Luther King setting himself to be killed, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Gandhi. One of my favorites is John Brown and his mm-hmm. Raid on Harper's Ferry, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. Came from a whole life of hearing a voice that said, "You need to end slavery." In the, you know, that's a long story, but it's a story I've studied because I find the character fascinating. Because what did John Brown do? He heard the voice of God telling him to end slavery, but it had to do with his personal experiences of slavery too, and seeing the ugliness of it, and getting close enough and letting it in. Okay, so now this voice comes to him and says, you know, do this thing. No psychologist in the world would sit down with John Brown and say, yeah, that's a really sensible thing to do. Is that what you ought to be doing in this moment? Let me open up these 14 psychology books. I don't find that anywhere in there. So what's going on there then? What kind of moral information is in that for us?
Yeah,
is there some point where there is something that's kind of reckless required of us in terms of the psychological in order to reach the moral? And I think my answer to that is that yes, there is. And then the question is, well, how do I unpack that in my day-to-day life, and what form does that take? It's an interesting question.
Yeah, I mean, ethics is a huge topic in psychology, and psychologists study ethics as a part of what they're doing. And a lot of it is, of course, ethical relationships with clients, but also I don't know if it's morality, though. I don't know if I think that ethics and morality are the same thing. I have to think about that. But I need to think more about the relationship between psychology and morality, I think.
Well, it's one to ponder, because here's where it goes. It goes to this place of, how much of the suffering of the world, if I follow my own little dogma or whatever, how much of it do I let in? Mm-hmm. How do I respond? How many of those voices do I listen to? How much of a sacrifice am I willing to make?
Right. Mm-hmm.
How much of my well-being am I willing to sacrifice in order to follow a voice, if the mm-hmm. voice doesn't lead me to a place that's nice and fuzzy? Because maybe it doesn't.
Right.
But maybe it's still the true voice, right, and the one that I should be hearing. And that's the question John Brown asked. Or was asked, I guess. That's kind of that same story that gets repeated through history. And these are moral heroes in history, as far as I'm concerned. They're people who heard the voice of suffering and responded in a way that you could argue wasn't exactly rational.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And
that's what's called
in this, from us, in this moment where we're really facing the end of our species and a lot of other things that have to do with social instability, nuclear war, everything else. Is there some kind of moral leap that needs to happen in terms of the way we look at the world that's, in a sense, unprecedented in this way?
Right.
So, and it's not,
right,
it can't be a leap toward magic. There's no, and the old baffling from the suffering that we have isn't working, so, yeah.
But the rational person can be seen as a madman when they're behaving in accordance with those kinds of principles that you're talking about, you know, somebody who tells us the truth.
I think it's one of the things
that
the system does to protect itself.
Yeah.
So the system has all these things built into it to protect the status quo and the homeostasis, right?
Right.
So one of the voices is going to be, the more you listen to suffering and the more you respond to it, the crazier you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be marginalized,
mm-hmm,
because that's how the system protects itself. In biology, where, you know, we have certain immune systems in our bodies, right? It's all there to keep the system intact and working exactly the way it works. And it's deep,
mm-hmm,
and it's complex. It goes all the way back to what you're talking about with Vance Packard and all this stuff. It's all in the system. And to deviate from that and start listening to suffering is a really subversive thing to do, and the system's not going to like it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I asked my minister, I was the only person in my family who went to church, and I loved my church, and I loved my minister, and I sang in all of the choirs, and I observed his kind of private life that seemed a little bit difficult, and I said, well, are you happy? And he said, I'm not sure we're meant to be happy.
Mm-hmm,
and I went,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
let me think about this. Do I want to follow you?
Very close to the heart of what we're talking about right there.
Exactly.
Are we meant to be happy,
yeah,
or are we meant to be? Are we meant to do the right thing?
Yeah.
They don't always align.
I don't believe they align.
I think it's magical to think that they will.
I agree.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, Steve, you have hardly had any.
You too. Great. You're leaving me in the dust here. I want to ask about contentment. Can you, maybe not happiness, but can contentment come if one has derived a moral stance, acts on it to the best of one's ability?
That's a good question. Another good question. It's kind of akin to the question of, can you have psychological well-being and radical morality on the mm-hmm. same plate? You know, and it's a really good question. I might have to say that I'm ignorant on the subject, because I don't feel any sense of contentment, really, most of the time. The only times I do, myself, just speaking personally, is when I'm connected to some kind of element in nature. So,
mm-hmm.
and this gets into this whole question of, you know, which is something else I like to kind of ponder. Is there a world where we struggle in our lives with these moral kinds of questions? And is there a world where we surrender at all and we just experience the other side of that, which is, on the one, there's this finite world of justice and all these questions that are agonizing and should torment us. On the other side, there are ultimate realities that are like infinity and death and all these kinds of things that are expansive. And when you go out and look at the stars or something, there's no morality. It's like you said earlier, it's amoral. I don't see a moral struggle there. I see an amoral beautiful, awesome universe that I can appreciate in a way that gives me some relief from this other thing. In other words, they're kind of yin and yang kinds of things, like one struggle, the other surrender. I think there is something healthy, if we're talking psychologically, about going from the arena of struggle into this arena of surrender and letting that happen too, because you can save yourself there. And at least I feel like that's how, in some ways, I do. Because there's, you mentioned the word contentment. That's the closest thing I know of, I guess, to contentment, is going to that world where there really isn't a moral process. And I think that happens in any place where nature is, you know, what I'll call nature is the dominant experience. So if I go up to Lassen and I camp by Juniper Lake or something, and I have a few days to just settle down there and get out of this sort of toxic stew of Chico and all of its social, you know, forces, there's a place that can happen there. The thing that I find interesting in terms of moral challenges is I think there are people who would like to lead us to think that there's a place like that that you can go and that that's a fulfilled and responsible life. Like, okay, I can meditate my way toward contentment.
Yeah,
I can
I
go
was
into
just
nature.
Thinking about Buddhism.
I have this sort of transcendent experience of life. Well, I question that because I think there's a way there to escape the kind of suffering I'm talking about, which drags us right back down into the city council chamber and something that's on the agenda that's actually really ugly and really ugly to confront or talk about or even consider. Because this would get into the whole nitty-gritty of what, you know, you saw my fence letter. Having our plaza right a couple blocks away fenced off deliberately for months and months and months so that the poorest people couldn't be on that plaza. Well, okay, if my Buddhism encompasses that and I'm there and I'm objecting, then that's a kind of Buddhism I respect. But if it's kind of Buddhism or any other kind of belief system that takes me to some place where I have contentment and I can stay there, that's not a... Okay, now is there some more, you know, like in the Bhagavad Gita where, you know, Krishna says, you know, I'm in the battle, but I'm not in the battle. Is there a place like that? If there is, I haven't found it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's not possible that someone could be in the battle and really be in the ugly, you know, most uncomfortable questions of the day and stand there and be there and at the same time be completely at peace. It sounds magical to me, but I'm not going to say it's not possible. I'll say I'm far from any achieving even the first part of standing with the suffering, you know. I mean, that's something I struggle to do at all because it's hard.
A lot of talk in the paper about finding common ground. Do you hold any hope that with all these fighting elements in the world?
A great question. Because it's like, I always say this, it's like my cliche answer, okay? 1820, the United States of America, slave states, free states, the whole battle that's going on. Common ground? Where do we meet in the middle on this?
No.
You don't. Mm-hmm. Because there are some certain moral imperatives that you can't just common ground your way out of. They involve polarities and dialectics that I think the question for me isn't like how to find common ground. The question is for me is what's the suffering saying? Does the suffering say go to the common ground? I haven't heard it say that yet. The suffering says act in response to this injustice you're seeing and experiencing. And the more I let that in, the louder that voice gets. It's never said common ground to me. But maybe it does to someone else. I don't know.
I'm going to go back to the Gita.
But it's a really good question.
Well, can I go back to the Gita for a second?
Go ahead. I want to throw in a book that I'm reading at the moment, American Nations by Colin Woodard, who talks about, he gets away from the idea of states as entities and says there are about 8 or 9 major cultures in the United States. And contrary to the notion that we're a melting pot, he says they're at each other's throat, have been since the beginning. Mm-hmm. The Constitution was a compromise between the patrician Virginians and the Calvinist New Englanders.
Mm-hmm.
And he says those values still permeate today. He says, and we're not finding comet grounds.
I think I read a review of that book or something.
It's about a decade old at this point, but I'm finding it an eye-opener in terms of who's at whose throats and why. And the notion that, we cannot maybe find common ground among some of those cultures.
Or that there's a kind of inevitability about civil, civil discord to the point where people talk about civil war and how there's been some pretty good stuff written about that lately too. Like what's baked in the cake now in terms of our ability to find enough, harmony to survive as a nation. But I don't know. I mean, these are questions that, I mean, if my dogma says listen to the suffering and it leads somewhere other than harmony, then my dogma says to listen to the suffering first.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
And then let that inform me. Now, is that irresponsible? Because maybe that discord, contributes to a kind of, societal breakdown or failure? Those are great questions. I just don't know how to answer them outside of the box of what I think a moral way of life looks like, right? Mm-hmm. It's a question between, in a sense, idealism and pragmatism. I think pragmatism might argue that, you might want to turn down that kind of suffering and maybe tune out that one or whatever, because if you do,
you can.
Things will be less contentious and you can find... I'm not saying that's wrong. I just, for me, that's just seems to be the way that we have operated mostly, Pragmatism dominates. And instead of tuning in the suffering, we tune it out. And then we have this Pandora's box of issues that, in the world.
Yeah. We have, no time left. But I want to go back to the Gita for 1 second. So,
Just keep talking. We'll get off.
The point when Krishna is talking to Arjuna, the point that he's making is you've got to act, and you've got to act with your whole heart. And the kind of the larger value there is that you act with all force and all feeling and all commitment, and you don't think of the consequences. It's irrelevant what the consequences are. Mm-hmm. It's your acting according to what you are committed to that matters.
Right. It's essentially, I would say, a hope-free zone. Like, you don't have an expectation.
Yeah,
you do
exactly.
You do it. In a purely existential way.
Yep, you just do it.
I think it's an interesting aspiration. I find for myself that if there isn't an element of hope, that I don't know what my basis is for my aspiration. In other words,
I don't think it eliminates the element of hope, but it's just not where you can stand. You can't stand in that hope. You stand in your action.
Well, to live that experience fully, it seems to me you would have to eliminate expectations completely, which to me would be like, I'm not, you know what I mean?
We're okay, we got a minute.
Oh, okay.
Keep going.
It's a great question. Something that I think, that could be the path to finding more peace in terms of being in the midst of, really contentious things and what the suffering says, because maybe there's a place to stand there. I can't say I've found it, I have to have a little bit of hope,
You want to say thank you, Patrick?
Oh, well, thank you guys. I have a feeling it's sort of like we're on the verge of a 4-hour conversation.
We'll have
to wrap it up, and it's really fun hanging out with you guys. So thank you.
Yeah. So Patrick Newman has been our guest. We've talked about the world,
the world as we know
ourselves, the world as we know it, the world inside of us, and the world out. Okay, Steve. Go.
Right on. In just a moment, Bobby Tryon will be here with North State Give and Take. She'll be talking with people from the American Association of University Women, AAUW, Carol Holtzgraf, Joan Cleveland, and Slew Blisman. Thank you for listening to Ecotopia. Great discussion tonight, guys.
Nearly every nation with an advanced economy and some not so advanced treats child care as a fundamental public good, essential to nurturing children, families, and the whole society. But not our U.S. of A. Indeed, our so-called leaders relegate millions of working parents and 21 million kids under five to the tender mercies of a for-profit market, with child care facilities ranging from impossibly expensive to helter-skelter unlicensed kiddie corrals. Embarrassingly, while right-wingers mindlessly salute the U.S. as exceptional, they fail to note that what's exceptional about our child care system is that it's such a shambles it can't even be called a system, much less caring. For the past decade, independent journalist and economic